DW Africa Link.
Time check here in Germany is exactly 6 p.m. A warm welcome to DW's African program, live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. This broadcast is live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Your comments are always welcome.
That's right, indeed. Coming up on the show, the U.S.-Africa Summit kicks off in Mozambique's capital, Maputo, and the focus will be mainly trade between Africa and the United States.
There are positive developments. For example, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which granted import duty exemptions to African states.
Former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been buried in the capital, Cairo, a day after his sudden death.
He didn't see his family for like 2 years continuously. He saw his family just twice within these 6 years. He was mistreated, actually.
These are some of the stories we've lined up for you, but first, here's the news in brief.
DW News.
I'm Kai Dombach with the DW News. The United Nations has called for an investigation into the death of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, who suddenly collapsed and died in a Cairo courtroom Monday. Morsi was privately buried in a cemetery in Cairo's eastern district of Nasser City. Morsi was the first democratically elected president after longtime leader Hosni Mubarak was ousted. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said Tuesday that she will not step down despite millions of protesters taking to the streets against her and an extradition bill.
I've said that I want another chance to deliver the many initiatives that will help Hong Kong's economy and improve the livelihood of the Hong Kong people. I myself and my political team, we will continue to work very hard to achieve those objectives and to meet the aspirations of the Hong Kong people.
Lam also apologized for her handling of the protests. This protester did not accept her apology.
None of us here feels the sincerity in her most sincere apology. We have set a deadline for the government. If they don't answer to our demands by June 20th, our protests may escalate.
A 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck northwestern Japan on Tuesday, triggering a tsunami advisory across several prefectures. The epicenter was just off the coast of the Yamagata Prefecture at a depth of 10 kilometers. The Japanese Meteorological Agency said there could be a tsunami of up to 1 meter in height. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. Former head of European soccer Michel Platini was arrested in Paris on charges of corruption. The charges against him stem from the alleged corruption surrounding Qatar winning the hosting rights for the 2022 FIFA World Cup. Platini said he was innocent in a statement. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said there was strong evidence that Iran was behind last week's twin tanker attacks near the Strait of Hormuz. Merkel added, however, that the increasing tensions must cool down.
We must do everything we can to resolve the conflict with Iran peacefully. That is what Germany is committed to. That is what the foreign minister has been to Iran for. We are in close contact with our American partners, and that is a very serious situation, as we know. But we will do everything in our power to influence all sides and, above all, to make it clear to Iran that this serious situation must not be aggravated.
Algerian Army Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Ahmed Gaed Salah accused some parties Tuesday of wanting a constitutional vacuum, which would continue the country's political crisis. After President Abdelaziz Bouteflika stepped down in April, protests have continued in the North African country, demanding the ruling elite step down. That includes interim President Abdelkader Ben Salah. And in the Women's World Cup, Group C play comes to an end Tuesday evening as Jamaica plays Australia and Italy takes on Brazil. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
And you're listening to DW's Africa Link program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Don't forget our Facebook page is where you can get the show live. Go drop your comments when we have time. We'll be reading the comments live.
Now, let's begin the show in Mozambique's capital, Maputo, where the US-Africa summit has kicked off. It is the top event for economic relations between Africa and the United States. The focus will be on agriculture, energy, health, infrastructure and finance.
Now, more than 1,000 private sector leaders, international investors, government representatives and multilateral stakeholders are expected to participate. The event follows on from previous summits in Washington in 2017 and Addis Ababa in 2016. Michael Oti has more to the story.
12 heads of state and government, including the presidents of Namibia, Zimbabwe, Guinea-Bissau and Malawi, have announced their intention to attend the U.S.-Africa Business Summit, which has begun in Mozambique's capital, Maputo. President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta will be among the keynote speakers. But despite the large presence of African leaders, the U.S. government will be poorly represented. The highest-ranking member of U.S. President Donald Trump's administration to attend will be Deputy Secretary of Commerce Karen Dan Kelly. Jad Devamont, Africa Director of the think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., explains why there's been little interest on the summit from Trump's administration.
I think that it was unlikely.
It was unlikely that President Trump would ever attend an event like this. He has done very little personally when it comes to Africa. He has so far only welcomed two African heads of state from sub-Saharan Africa to the Oval Office. I think this is disappointing.
Partly disappointing.
However, this doesn't mean that the U.S. is not interested in economic relations with Africa. Philip Gigg, political scientist at the University of Würzburg, sees U.S. foreign policy in Africa as being unpredictable.
There are positive developments. For example, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which granted import duty exemptions to African states. And there have been economic initiatives, though small, but they have certainly been successful. What the U.S.-Africa policy is missing is dynamics. This can be seen from the fact that the highest-ranking post for Africa at the State Department was vacant for a year and a half. If no one there is specifically responsible for Africa, then that's not where the U.S. focus lies.
It should be recalled that U.S. direct investment recently reached $57 billion. An estimated 600 U.S. companies, including some of the largest, are active in South Africa alone.
Michael Oti with that report.
And of course, Eddie, as you've heard in that report, the U.S. is not being represented by a senior cabinet, you know, secretary, but rather a junior, presumably because, or just mentioned by an analyst there, it's not so keen, you know, doing trade, especially Trump administration, it's not so keen doing trade with Africa.
Exactly. I mean, that was one of the things, if you remember, Isaac, we talked about when he was elected president in the very first months. It wasn't clear what really, first of all, his policies were, especially on Africa. And again, regarding the clip, it doesn't really show how much Africa can then benefit from all of this. What kind of mutually beneficial relationship there is. Things are a bit too scrappy, but at least we can tell that investments have increased a bit.
Yeah, well, to the many people who followed his campaign, all three said, America first. So I'm not surprised that this is an initiative of the private sector, the American private sector, taking the lead. Anyway, in case you would like to comment on this story, just go to our Facebook page, DW Africa, and leave your comment there. We shall come back to it whenever time allows us.
But moving on to other stories, former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been buried in the capital, Cairo. That's a day after his sudden death. Morsi's son said authorities refused to allow the former leader be buried in his hometown, Sharqiya province.
And his Muslim Brotherhood has blamed poor conditions in the prison where he'd been held since 2013. Human rights groups, including Amnesty, are calling for an independent investigation, while DW's Imad Hassan from the Arabic department has been telling me the general mood in Egypt following Morsi's death and the conditions under which he died. Take a listen.
He didn't see his family for like 2 years continuously. He saw his family just twice within these 6 years. He was mistreated, actually. The other part of the Egyptians, maybe they don't like the Muslim Brotherhood or the president who represents, who should represent the Egyptian people, but he was more representing the Muslim Brotherhood. They felt also a kind of sorry for what happened to him. So there is a kind of mixed reaction, but most of the Egyptians, and especially on the social media, you can find easily that they are sad and they are shocked.
Following what you just said, Human Rights Watch Director for Middle East Sarah Leah Whitson criticized the Egyptian government's failure to allow him adequate medical care, much less family visits. So in other words, there is justification for comments, or you were shocked yourself when you heard what she said?
Actually, what Sarah Leah Whitson said was not something new, especially that Human Rights Watch and Amnesty raised the flag about 2 years ago about the medical conditions of Mohamed Morsi. And they were very annoyed about his medical conditions. For me, as a person who is following closely what's happening in Egypt, actually, most of the people who were using to follow what's happening in the Egyptian prisons were expecting a kind of death for Morsi. The man is 68 years old with high blood pressure and lots of other diseases. And it was amazing he withstood all these 7 years with his health. It was expected.
Now, tributes have been pouring in from countries like Iran and Turkey, with thousands in Istanbul alone turning up for prayers today. How much has Morsi's death impacted his followers and countries that have a connection to the Muslim Brotherhood?
We witnessed since yesterday, like, callings for prayers in Gaza, in Al-Aqsa Mosque, in Turkey, and even in Iran and Malaysia, and lots of countries, actually, not only about Muslim Brotherhood that these callings were coming from, but also from other people who used to look at Egypt as a role model in Africa and in the Middle East that has elected freely a president.
The Muslim Brotherhood has called for mass protests. I'm sure you've been following on this. Do you see this most likely to happen?
No, not for sure. In Egypt, it's something like impossible to happen in Egypt. Maybe some kind of demonstrations in front of the Egyptian embassies here and there. But inside Egypt, I think most of the Egyptians have learned the lesson in a hard way.
I was speaking to DW's Emad Hassan from the Arabic department, who's been telling me more about the death of the first democratically elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, who died suddenly yesterday while appearing in court.
Well, and there's been definitely comments on our Facebook page. We basically were asking you guys to tell us your thoughts after his death. Well, Caleb Chawaro from Nairobi, Kenya says, "There's more than meets the eye. Mohamed Morsi might have succumbed to torture while in prison. His death is a shame to Egyptian democracy."
And Arinze Chuku Herim says, "Sorrow for his death. I blame the military for not giving him judgment after several years in jail before he passed away."
Edwin Chubeting Engan says, "It is imperative for Egypt to carry out a thorough and impartial investigation into the death of the former president. He was held in solitary confinement for 6 years.
Well, his comment just, you know, resonates well with what the United Nations Rights Commission has been saying, you know, that they need to carry out an independent investigation into the circumstances that led to the death of, you know, Mohamed Morsi. And Marco Dux says, "The ball is in Egypt's court to stand up against the injustices perpetuated by the West against them. Mohamed Morsi was duly elected by the Egyptian people, and the fact that he died and is being buried like normal citizen without a proper state funeral speaks for itself."
Well, looks like many of the comments are related to this.
Exactly. Actually, many thanks for those comments. Now, Eddie, let's talk about our YouTube channel, DW Africa. We have new episodes, and one that stands out is "How is digitization impacting African youth?"
I remember that one. It was done in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Kimani was in Ghana interacting with young Africans who really are in the tech business. And I think it's really one answer. Digitalization definitely is the future, and we have to delve more into it.
Just go to our DW Africa channel, click, watch, sit back, relax, and enjoy. And don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends wherever they are.
This is Africa Link coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. Always a pleasure to have you with us. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And my name is Isaac Mugabe. As usual, you can always join us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Remember that this program is broadcast from Monday up to Friday throughout our partner radio stations across the continent. Don't forget also to share your comments with us. And coming up in the next 15 minutes, still no explanation from the government a week after Ethiopia shut down its internet and messaging services. So how are businesses coping?
So many people, companies are really frustrated with this internet shutdown. They failed to do their job. They told us they are really frustrated. They can't do anything.
We'll also find out why a Malian living in France returned home to set up his dream restaurant. More reason to stay tuned in, including reading your comments live on air.
Now, Eddie, in this digital era, imagine surviving without an internet. I know you are, you know, tech savvy, always with your phone, wherever you are, even at the canteen.
Okay, Isaac, let's not go too far.
So just imagine surviving without an internet, how it feels like.
Very difficult.
Now, it's been over a week and Ethiopia's internet and text messaging service is still shut down or in some parts of the country not working properly. There has still been no official explanation given by the government. Citizens are angry as this is affecting many sectors of the country.
Now, this is not the first time the internet has been shut down. It happened in 2016 and 2017 to prevent cheating and leaking of papers during national exam period. Many believe the current shutdown is for the same reason. Now, I earlier spoke to DW's Ashete Bekele from the Amharic Department. He starts by describing the current shutdown.
After they shut down the internet in some part of the country, it started again. But in eastern, southeast part of, and also northern part of the country, still the internet is not working. One. The second one is, even if you have the signal, even if it seems working, but it's not properly operating.
So how different is this from previous shutdowns?
So Ethiopia is not new in shutting down internet, the service. Back in 2016 and 17, the same kind of thing happened. Back then, it was shut down all over the country. But this time, some parts of the country, for example, in Addis Ababa, you might have the internet in your cellular, in your phone, but it might be weak, poor, but at least they have. Back in the day, they just close everything.
And why do you think this is the case now?
We try to reach the government. They failed to give us a clear explanation why they shut down the internet and also how they shut down the internet.
What do we know about businesses, for instance, and people that have been affected?
So many people, companies are really frustrated with this internet shutdown. There are taxi services which control their service providers through the internet. So they failed to do their job. They failed to control how their operators are doing their job. Internet companies who are trying to develop websites, apps, new apps, who are working with foreign companies in the US, in India, they told us they are really frustrated. They can't do anything.
However, some of the young Ethiopians are trying to find a way around this, right?
VPN, yeah.
Yeah. How's that going?
I mean, that works only in Addis Ababa. If the government blocked some specific apps, messaging apps, for example, Telegram is becoming very famous these days in Ethiopia. Mm. So it's blocked by the service provider. Mm-hmm. So the young generation installed a VPN in their cell phone and then tried to cross over the blockade.
New Prime Minister Ahmed, what does this really mean for his government and his image?
Everybody is questioning his administration. Why did they close the government?
To what extent can you blame him? Because, I mean, he's the Prime Minister.
We don't know. That's the point. We don't know who decided to close the internet. The national exam might be the case, trying to prohibit leaking, cheating.
That's what people think, that because of the exam.
That's what people are thinking. But if there is any dirty game behind, definitely the government is responsible, and it's a really bad thing.
How are ongoing plans to diversify the telecoms industry to create competition for other game changers?
A couple of days ago, the government officials said that within a couple of months, a new service providers will join the market. That might ease the pressure on the government and also Ethio Telecom.
So now still not clear when the internet is going to return.
My people are expecting today. Yeah.
People are like checking their phones, checking the internet to see, because the exam ends today, right?
Yeah, it's already ended. So people are waiting if the service will be back this time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was speaking to DW's Ashete Bekele.
Africa on the move.
And yes, it is Africa on the Move, a segment that highlights positive stories coming out of Africa. Driven by the will to survive in a country of little prospects, many young Malians travel abroad to find work and send money back home to their families. But Moussa Sissoko is determined to break this cycle.
Yes, indeed. He gave up a new life in France to open his own restaurant in the heart of Bamako. Although he faced major challenges, it did not stop him from realizing his dream. Here's a report by Annabel Steffes, presented by Zipporah Nyambura.
It's rush hour at the restaurant La Baye du Palais in the heart of Bamako. Moussa Sissoko owns this restaurant and is also the chef. He lives for his dream of owning a restaurant. And to set himself apart from his competitors, he's come up with a lot of new ideas.
The most important ingredient is mozzarella, but you can't get it in Mali. I bring it back with me from France. I'm the only one in Mali who serves mozzarella, no one else.
Moussa Sissoko began in 2015 with just 80 euros in his pocket. For 10 years, he illegally lived and worked in France and could only set aside a little bit of money to go towards his restaurant plan. Like many African migrants, he sent at least half of his meagre annual earnings back to his family.
That's just the way things were. You had to do it. I just wondered if this is what I really wanted. I kept sending money to my family and they're still poor. But I'm also still poor myself. So I told myself that I'll cut off contact with my family and work towards my goal to open a restaurant in Mali.
According to the World Bank, African migrants sent almost 900 million euros back to their families in 2017. This money helped build everything from houses to entire villages with new schools and hospitals. Moussa Sissoko broke this cycle. Instead, he used his savings to buy a stove, oven and meat grinder in France, which he eventually brought back with him to Mali. His brother said he would help him set up the restaurant, but things didn't exactly go to plan.
I asked him to pick up the appliances while I went to France for 3 months to work. He told me it wasn't a problem at all. But when I left, he sold the appliances and went back to our village. He sold everything. When I heard about it, I was devastated.
But even this setback didn't stop Sissoko. Nobody understood why he wanted to return to his homeland. But he remains firmly convinced that Mali has much to offer. It's just up to the Malians themselves to recognize the opportunities available and help bring their country forward.
There's no chemicals in here. It's all organic. I buy my ingredients here to boost the local economy. And so, in the end, we all benefit.
He makes these sacrifices in the hope of realizing his biggest dream of all, to see his wife and two small daughters again who are still living in France.
Zipporah Nyambura with that report.
And before we go further on the show, we'd like also to remind you about one of our projects, that is the 77% for the youth. Made for the youth and tailored for the youth. And Eddie Micah, Junior, my host here, is one of the people behind, you know, the production of this amazing segment. You know, tell us more about it, Eddie.
Amazing is definitely the word. And I'm definitely proud to be one of the voices on the program. I mean, the 77% is all about marking the fact that 77% of Africa's population is under the age of 35. So it is the most youthful continent. And we're saying that the future, of course, belongs to the youth. Now, it's basically a platform where these young folks on the continent come to share ideas, talk about what makes them proud to be Africans, and also discuss issues, but not just talk about them, find solutions to these issues, because of course they have the brains to think up things.
And if you're listening to us right now, whatever you had Eddie say, if you want to learn more about it, just go to our page, dw.com/Africa. You'll see the 77% street debate. There's so many interesting topics like digitization in Ghana and combating radicalization. They're all tailored for the youth. Yeah. Enjoy. Mm-hmm.
Focus Europe.
Yes, let's focus a little bit on Europe. In an unprecedented move, Istanbul will rerun its mayor election on June 16th At end of March, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK Party was defeated in the city's local elections, ending its 25-year control of Istanbul. That result was widely seen as a political game-changer.
But a rerun was called after the authorities annulled the vote over irregularities. The country's opposition and the European Union said the move was undemocratic. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul that the election is now more than just about who runs the city.
Ekrem İmamoğlu of the opposition CHP party is back on the campaign trail. He's promising to win the Istanbul mayoral election again and correct the injustice of having his March victory denied. İmamoğlu is now repeating his winning formula of focusing on the needs of the people, with promises of creches, provisions of food for the needy and expanding services across the city. However, he says a rerunning of the Istanbul vote means the poll is now more than just about who is mayor.
This is both a local election and a fight for democracy. That's why our campaign is growing bigger. It's clear that what we're going through is above party politics. However, this is an opportunity to reconcile society and unite people.
Given a second chance, the AKP candidate, Binali Yildirim, is seeking to change the political narrative by taking his campaign to Turkey's main Kurdish city, Diyarbakir. Speaking in broken Kurdish, he addresses a crowd of supporters and then goes on to reach out for their votes.
I've come here to request your support. Diyarbakir has always been on our side. Inshallah, it will be on our side again this time.
The Kurdish vote is seen as a critical factor behind İmamoğlu's success in the March polls. Kurdish music is now widely being played at AKP campaign stalls across Istanbul. More significantly, in the last few weeks, Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned Kurdish leader of the outlawed PKK, is now being allowed to see his lawyers after a six-year hiatus, fueling speculation of a resumption in peace talks. But political analyst Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadahas University is skeptical that Kurds will change their allegiances.
I doubt that it will have much of an impact, because this is too little too late. The Kurds, I think they're politically savvy enough to know if they continue to vote the way they did, the HDP guys, they will have more of a bargaining power, and not just with the government, but also with the opposition, of which they are informally a part.
İmamoğlu, too, has taken his campaign outside the city, touring the Black Sea region where he comes from. Tens of thousands came out in support, despite the area being a stronghold of Erdogan. Analyst Soli Özel says the president could be preparing for defeat.
We thought that President Erdogan was going to have 39 meetings in all 39 districts of Istanbul. He will not. He's nowhere to be seen. So this has now become Binali Yildirim's campaign, okay? And it makes sense, because that way, if there is another defeat at the end of the road, it will not be Erdogan's defeat, whereas the 31st of March was, by and large, Erdogan's defeat.
Most opinion polls put İmamoğlu ahead. The question on the minds of both parties is what Yildirim's AKP can do to gain the upper hand just days before the election.
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul. Now, for more key stories across Africa and Europe, check out our website at dw.com/Africa and dw.com/Europe, respectively.
And for sports lovers, tonight's much-awaited game, Women's World Cup, is between Italy and Brazil. Mm-hmm. But of course, to many, the loss of Nigeria in last evening's match with France is still fresh on their minds.
Including my mind. I was watching that game and they were holding on. It was going to be a draw and I was like, oh, just hold on. But
yeah, and most of the supporters of the Nigerian Falcons are really livid and angry with the video assistant referee.
That's that, causing a lot of problems.
That gave the penalty to France. Anyway, we hope other games pan out well and the Super Falcons can continue. With that, we come to the end. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
Bye for now.
DW Made
for minds.